The True False podcast is made possible with the support of the University of Missouri and the Donald W. Reynolds Journalism Institute.
Welcome to the True False Film Festival.
Welcome to the True False podcast, presented by KBIA. I'm Allison Kofeldt. Today, we're talking with Pete Nix, a director, writer, and producer based in Oakland, California, where he's been living with his family for more than two decades. Pete's most recent film, The Force, is the second in a planned trilogy that centers on public institutions in Oakland. The first film in the series, The Waiting Room, takes place in Highland Hospital. The Force looks at Oakland's police department, the year its world turned upside down. Both titles have played a True False. True False's very own Paul Sturtz spoke with Pete about how his life experiences influenced him as a filmmaker. They started by discussing Pete's making of The Force.
You did quite a few ride-alongs and hung out with cops quite a bit. How did your views of your own city evolve because of this experience?
First of all, like when you get inside a police car and you start riding around, you immediately feel that sort of glare, that stare through the window. It's like hate. It's the police are not looked on favorably at all by a large, segment of the population. That said, we also experienced Gianna Watson, who was the public information officer for the police and who's a character in the film and is also a public figure in the city because she's the one who's on the local news all the time. So people recognize her. Whenever we were with her and sort of rolling around, it was like a love fest. People loved her and would stop and talk to her and sometimes give her a hug. And it was really encouraging in terms of countering this narrative you've heard about the distrust and the vibe between the community and the police. You saw a much more kind of positive sort of interaction there. But, when we were in patrol cars, particularly at night, sort of rolling around, it was a whole different deal. And there was you can just feel that the tension was there. And, this is a job where I'm going, I'm putting a bulletproof vest on every day going to work. And so I'm feeling that. I'm wondering, what's going to happen? I'm wondering, am I putting myself in, danger? I'm wondering, who do they think I am? And so you really get a very visceral kind of sense of that. And then as the weeks, months go by, you kind of get used to it. But then you start to recognize that you're seeing the worst parts of the city. When you're going out on these calls, and so much of what we saw was domestic violence. The frequency of domestic violence was shocking. And that was one of the first big things I was like, wow, this is a problem. And it was mostly people of color, mostly Hispanic and African-American families that were being called to. So that was something that I recognized right away. And, when you look at talking about that city and sort of the stereotyping, the view, it was not a pretty picture. And so we immediately were faced with this question of how do we show all this without sort of showing a distorted view of the city?
So when you're walking around East Oakland right now, are you more comfortable or more anxious because of all the knowledge that you have from those ride-alongs?
No, I think, I don't know. I mean, and I have my own personal experience, which I don't know how much you want to get into it, but I was arrested in college and went to federal prison. So I've been in rooms of, with characters that I've lived a very diverse life. And when I was using and sort of prowling the streets at 2 a.m, I had no problem, going into crack houses and sort of putting myself into really sketchy situations. And so I think that's never left me. And also sort of being at Highland Hospital made me realize that people who may look dangerous or may look, threatening actually are not. you know, once you start talking to them and sort of get it, it really depends on the context. And there are very, very few sort of situations that you're going to get into, even in a city like Oakland, that's third most dangerous city in the country, that are going to be potentially harmful to you. It's really mental and psychological. That said, you have to be smart, you know, and that's where you get into sort of, you know, the natural process of profiling, of sort of looking around and trying to identify potentially dangerous situations. And I think for cops, it becomes a habit, sort of looking at people in certain ways. And so we got sort of a real feel for that. And we saw a lot of cops who don't use force. The cop in our film, I don't think he's ever fired his gun, or at least at the time that we had filmed, he's an African-American cop, whereas other cops have fired their guns and killed multiple people. So it's really, it's like there's such a difference between sort of how people view the environment and how they behave in that same environment.
So you touched on your own history. I think just for context, it would be helpful for you just to give us a short description of
sure.
of that history and, you know, how it informs the work that you're doing in Oakland right now.
Yeah, I had a serious drug problem in college that led to me basically with a kid who had dropped out of Georgetown. I was at Howard at the time, getting involved in a scheme where we were importing cocaine through the U.S. mail, and got arrested, got sentenced to federal prison time. This is at the height of the war on drugs, and I think arrested in 89, served time in 1990 in a federal prison in West Virginia for about a year, got out, did about 6 months in a halfway house, and then kind of like began like a long process of sort of coming back to my life that, you know, involved another 3 years of probably the heaviest and most destructive drug use that I've had. And it was kind of miraculous that I was able to, you know, finally find a place, find my recovery. And eventually in 94, or actually December 6, 1993, got clean. And then, you know, met my wife, my future wife in 94. And that sort of began my path, you know, to where I am today and being able to tell these stories. And, you know, along the way, just meeting so many different people, meeting young African-American men just like me, but who came from, you know, environments that, you know, didn't grow up in, like in a Cosby Show kind of, you know, yeah. house, that, you know, were on their third or fourth tour in prison, who had nothing to look forward to after prison. And me, you know, my recovery, like everybody wanted to be part of my story, everybody wanted to be, play a role in that. And it just sort of always pulled at me, sort of all these young men that I met, like, where are they now? And I think, you know, Obama actually just pardoned a guy who was locked up. This guy named Lil D, he's a well-known drug dealer in Oakland. And he was locked up right around the same time I was locked up. And he just got out. Hmm. And because he was dealing in crack cocaine, and the sentencing, you know, for crack, you know, was much more severe than for powdered cocaine, which is what I was arrested for. So those experiences really, and sort of getting to know these men in prison, and, you know, really had an impact on me, and were some of the same characters that I met in the waiting room, and obviously were some of the same characters that I met while making the force. And also the cops who arrested me were super nice. You know, they, I mean, I remember the day that I was arrested very well, and I was treated with respect, and it was almost like they recognized who I was, or I, you know, and I probably would not, you know, have been treated the same way were I different, were I not in college, or were I not the color of my skin, or how I dressed, or how I spoke. And that always sort of pulled at me and wanted me to sort of, you know, tell that story, tell the story of the people that I've met along my journey.
Coming up after the break, Pete talks about his identity and how it shaped his approach to storytelling.
you talk to anybody who's Black, and one of the things that's interesting is sort of asking the question of, like, when was the first time you realized that you were Black?
But first, a quick word from our sponsor. Hey, listeners, it's Allison, letting you know that this episode of the True False podcast is brought to you by the University of Missouri. That's also where we produce this show, here at the KBIA studios at the University of Missouri School of Journalism, which is famous for the Missouri Method. So we've got Catherine Wheeler here in the studio. Catherine's a graduate student at the University of Missouri School of Journalism, and she is a producer on our podcast for True False. Hey, Catherine.
Hi.
Thank you for producing this episode.
It's a joy.
And I was hoping you could tell us what you mean, or we say, Missouri Method.
Well, with the J School, we're kind of getting thrown into the deep end right away. I don't know any other place where on my first day of class, I was writing feature stories for the local newspaper, and I'm working at the local NPR affiliate doing stories. There are just so many options to really get professional experience even before we go out into our professional careers.
Yeah, the experience stuff is really what stands out, I think.
Yeah.
The True False podcast is made possible by the University of Missouri. This episode of the True False podcast is brought to you by the Donald W. Reynolds Journalism Institute. Here to tell us more is current RJI fellow Chris Guess. Hey, Chris.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. So what's your elevator pitch for your project?
Sure. If you're a small and medium-sized news organization, if you're a local paper or radio station, getting on board with modern mobile news app systems is expensive and probably not really an option for you. So this is something that lets you basically take a pre-made system, modify it to your needs. In a couple days, you can have a completely native iOS and Android apps for all your readers.
Oh, yeah. That sounds amazing.
Yeah, it's a lot cheaper than the $50K that it usually costs. So.
Yeah, and this would be free, open source.
Completely free. Anybody can take it. Anybody can download it. You change a couple config files. You might have to hire a developer for like 2 or 3 days. That's what RJ is letting me work on.
Chris, again, he is a current Reynolds Journalism Institute fellow. You can find out more at rjionline.org. That's rjionline.org. You're listening to the True False podcast presented by KBIA. I'm Allison Kofeldt. True False's Paul Sturtz is talking with director Pete Nix about his film, The Force.
I wanted to ask you about you as a biracial man. Has that been helpful in making these stories? I don't know how people read you, whether they know that you're biracial or whether they view you as Black or white. Has that been helpful or not helpful in terms of getting access and getting people to be comfortable with you?
I think, you know, I think it definitely has influenced me in terms of who I am as a storyteller. And I mean, you talk to anybody who's Black, and one of the things that's interesting is sort of asking the question of, like, when was the first time you realized that you were Black? And I think for everyone, it's got different sort of responses. For me, it was like in elementary school, kids asking me, what are you? You know, me having to sort of answer that question. But, you know, for me, it was always a direct answer. I'm Black because, you know, my birth mother was white, my birth father was Black, and I was born in Ohio in 1968. Her family threatened to disown her, or there was some tension around the idea of her marrying this guy, this Black guy, and having me and raising me at that time. And that led to her giving me up for adoption. Very difficult choice that she had to make. And it just so happened that I was adopted by a Black family. My dad's from Charleston, South Carolina. My mom's parents came over from West Africa. And I grew up in the Black church. They were very active in the civil rights movement. I went to Howard University. So I internalized all that on an identity level. But the reality is that I didn't personally experience things that, you know, you hear from other African Americans, like being thrown on the hood of a car by a cop or being called nigger. I mean, I think I got called nigger once or twice, you know, but I didn't experience in a very visceral way. And so that, as a storyteller, it does allow me to sort of enter into spaces where I can be more, whatever you want to call it, objective or non-emotional or not so focused on telling a single story. And I've never sort of thought actively about, I don't want to, life, it's more complicated. It's always more complicated. But I've always been drawn to those stories that have that kind of complexity, and I grew up with that complexity in my life. So I think it is reflected in my approach to these stories that, you know, can be divisive or black and white.
Yeah, it seems like knowing you over the last many years, I assume that you've always had this quality of, you just ooze equanimity. I don't think anybody meets Pete Nix and says, oh, man, that guy is a little, he's too obnoxious, or, you know, why is he always so angry and contentious? You seem to have this quality that people would feel very comfortable with.
Well, I mean, I think part of it, like, I'm naturally non-confrontational. I don't know where that comes from. But, you know, it's interesting because sometimes that can be perceived as a weakness. In some contexts, that can be perceived as a weakness. And in my journey, both at Howard and being in Oakland throughout this really singular moment where voices are being raised and we're questioning this idea of justice and race as it is manifesting itself with police brutality and all these cases, that I have very close friends who are those people who are, whatever you want to call them, like uncompromising activists, people who are really fighting. And I, on a personal level, I have a deep respect for these activists who have risen up and stood firm in an uncompromising way. At the same time, for me personally, I have to ask, sort of in my storytelling, if we're fighting for justice, what are the compromises that we're going to make? Like, you can't compromise your values in the fight for justice. That's something that I think, that's how I was raised. And, you know, we're all flawed on some level. I grew up in the black church. Black people are incredibly homophobic. You know, you look at the Panthers, the misogyny in the Black Panthers. So being black does not sort of anoint you as sort of a morally superior creature. And I think, you know, Shakespeare is timeless for a reason, that we all have our flaws, our moral failures. And that is the grist of storytelling in my mind. And so I like to sort of, you know, dive in there. And I think me being kind of raised and being mixed race or whatever, who I am, kind of lends to that kind of approach to storytelling. But I try not to suggest that, you know, this is the only, that my approach, you know, a polemic storytelling or you know, activist filmmaking plays a very important role in the ecosystem of all that's being told today.
And that approach and outlook, I think, comes through loud and clear in The Force. I don't think any of the groups are romanticized in any way. I don't think anyone could come out of the film and say, you know, the police department, they're a wonderful group of people, and, you know, the government doesn't come out.
I think so.
Looking, you know, squeaky clean. And the activists, you know, it's a complex portrait of activists. I don't think, yeah, it's quite as Pollyannish as probably, you know, some people would have preferred that portrait to be of, you know, the hardworking, you know, reformers who are pushing for the civil.
But we could have.
Yeah, go ahead.
But we could have done that. Part of my approach is a recognition of the massive, that just the profound responsibility we have as nonfiction storytellers. You know, we could have made a cut of the film that made the cops look way better or way worse, and the community. Like, we had hundreds of hours of protest footage. We could have cut that thing together. That would have been a devastating an indictment of sort of the activist movement, you know, and some of the characters that are sort of leaders in it. And, you know, that is something that I think as nonfiction storytellers, we all have to sort of remind ourselves that we have an awesome power to influence how people perceive reality. For me, like, the divisions, And we're seeing now how sort of Russia has, you know, exploited that. And I said, you know, this is a country right now that is divided, that there's a lot of hate and anger, and they went in and exploited that. And for me, part of my mission is to try to remind people that we are still one, you know, a country that has flaws, that is struggling to sort of define its own values and sort of who we are, what our identity is as Americans. And Oakland is a city that really sort of encapsulates this idea. It's like we're all in the stew together, and we are, you know, in Oakland, we're Oaklanders, but we're part of America. You know, we're Americans, and what does that really mean?
Is Oakland the kind of place where if you say, oh, I've been here 20 years, people think, oh, well, this guy is pretty rooted here, or are you considered still a blow-in?
I think you have to be born here. I think there's something about it being in your inner DNA that's different than being a transplant. And I think from my point of view, I've always felt as an outsider trying to understand a place and being, you know, fascinated with a place. I've always been fascinated. And it really began with, you know, my wife's work at Highland Hospital, which is, you know, one of the first jobs she took after graduate school was at this public hospital. And the stories that she came home telling me really sparked my interest in making a film about that place, that hospital, and that really kind of launched and set the stage for the idea of doing more.
It's maybe a little bit tacky to ask it, but I mean, just that the town is in such turmoil that way with gentrification and crime and all these other narratives that are going on, does it make it a lot easier for you as a filmmaker to make interesting films?
I think that it's rich in that sense where you have, these are all national issues, whether you're talking about housing, gentrification, education, access to healthcare, criminal justice. Each of those are pretty significant sort of national conversations that are playing themselves out on a local stage right here in a way that really, to my eye, Oakland reflects what America is becoming more and more, which is increasingly diverse. The demographics of the country are changing. That's unavoidable. It's a very dynamic place that is actually challenging to tell stories in, particularly if you're perceived as an outsider. And so for me, it's a very tricky environment to navigate in. And I think that to some degree came to bear with when The Force came out, it was not met with widespread appreciation. It raised all kinds of issues inside the community that was very different than sort of the response we got to the film nationally, because it does reveal some very difficult and challenging realities of the city.
When did you start inquiring whether it would be possible to make that film? Because you obviously needed to get the police department to sign off on that. And I can't imagine that was easy.
No, I mean, particularly because they were under federal watch. Like they were being monitored by the federal government for past civil rights violations. But it turns out that the city and the police department, that, you know, we just needed their sign off. And so we had an MOU that was circulated for more than, I think it was about a year, roughly. I think the leaders of the city, both within the department and in the city government, recognized that, you know, transparency as a value was important at this moment in time when there was a national conversation around police accountability. This was a department that was under reform, that was being forced to make changes, and they saw the value in that being documented. And that was our intent, was to say, hey, this is a department in active reform. What does that look like? You know, what does this relationship look like between the department and the city? And so that's what really, I think, got us, you know, in the door.
So I wanted to hear you talk about reform or improvements. And when you look at these big institutions, when you look at Oakland, when you look at, you know, some of the big stuff that you've tackled, mm-hmm. like, are we being naive to think that, you know, by just throwing some money and some intention behind it, we can solve these problems.
You know, there's always going to be failure. And I think in my story, that occurred, you know, and I, you know, try to, you know, in all of my storytelling, insert a degree of hope, because that's the story of my life, and it got really bad, but I was able to bounce back. And I think the humanity is in a constant cycle of sort of, you know, failure and reform, and that's never going to change. I mean, that will never change. What made the difference for me was sort of an internal narrative. And I think that what we're trying to do is change, tell our stories so that we can change the story, you know, that, you know, the ability of a community to change is rooted in its internal narrative. And I don't think a police department can change that. I don't think an education system can change that, or a healthcare system can change that. It's a deeper sort of idea that I'm trying to get at in my storytelling.
The Force won the Documentary Directing Award at the 2017 Sundance Film Festival. You can listen to more episodes like this one on the True False podcast. Find us at kbia.org or on iTunes. And join us the next time as we discuss a different aspect of the art and craft of nonfiction storytelling. The True False podcast is made possible with support from the University of Missouri. Special thanks to Pete Nix and Paul Sturtz for the interview. This episode was produced by Catherine Wheeler and edited by Ryan Femuliner and Bram Sablesmith. Special thanks to Abby Ivory Gagne. Our introduction was created by Tim Pilcher using sounds from the True False Film Fest. I'm Allison Kofelt. Thanks for listening.